man. This aircon is racist.
I've never ever been a spy.
Can the PBS bank loot?
The problem is that Pinky.
I'll never subject myself to white men. I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a ship.
Can you please come in? Order.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Sunday Times Politics Weekly with me, Amil Amrao. Thank you guys so much for joining us this week. We have a jam-packed edition this week for everyone to listen into, and thank you so much for following us as well. Our following has grown substantially. We really appreciate the support, guys. In studio this week, I have Zingisa Mvumvu, Zimasa Matiwane, and award-winning journalist, again and again,
so
we have been graced. We have been graced.
You must emphasize, I mean, it's not just any award.
It's not just
this
any award.
This is the Netna customer, man. The biggest honor.
How does it feel? How does it feel, Q? Come on, tell us.
How does it feel?
No, I'm like blushing.
Humble at that.
This thing is in the league of the Pulitzer Award, my man.
You think?
No, Netna customer. Yes, yes. Don't play with.
So, as promised, we have brought Exodus into the studio. Thanks, guys, and let's get straight into it. We're going to get straight into our first section. It's called The Good, The Bad, and The Newsworthy. Let's start off with the DA. Now, the party has gone through a lot of its own racial relation issues over the past couple of years, specifically before elections. It suffered a bit of a crippling blow there when it came to its race relations. But now again, we see party members and senior party members fighting amongst themselves. This in the form of Phumzile Van Damme and Helen Zille. Now, this is where it all started. If I remember correctly, Phumzile Van Damme, DA's MP, was sort of accosted at the V&A waterfront in Cape Town in a bit of a racial incident where she ended up punching the guy who was the alleged perpetrator of that incident. All fine and good. Phumzile took it up. There was a massive debacle around it. And everything was going fine until Helen Zille, who we all know has a bit of a mouth on Twitter for such things, tweeted, "I wish the family would come forward and give us their perspective, but I suppose they are scared of potential consequences. It is hard in these circumstances to work out where the truth lies." Now, one would have expected that as a senior party leader, the first thing you would tweet is to give support to your fellow colleague, right? But that wasn't the case. Now, Phumzile Van Damme came back, this time relentless in her response to Zille, saying anyone with an iota of intelligence would watch Petz's video and laugh. "You invalidate my experience. I was made to feel subhuman. I was threatened. In addition to that, I must be dragged through the mud. And you gladly join the mob with your 1 million followers. I don't kneel to bullies." Now, interesting response from Phumzile here. Actually, one of the first black members of the DA's party to sort of speak out against Helen Zille's racism. What do you guys make of this? Is it an example of some of the race relations currently dividing the DA?
Well, for me, I mean, this of course is an isolated incident. You know, my view is that in South Africa there's still a lot of racial tensions to this day, and I don't think we're being honest in our discussion around those as such. That's why you'll always have these events whereby they, you know, go out into the open and people are fighting. I mean, within the DA itself, which mostly claims to be a party for all, you know, and you see that Helen Zille deliberately decided to take that side to sort of rubbish the allegations of Phumzile Van Damme that she was a victim of a racial confrontation. So I think it's just a general problem that we have as a country, that we don't discuss these things. We sweep them under the carpet in the interest of reconciliation, the interest of, you know, so-called rainbow nation, which as far as I'm concerned is an illusion, because you know, when you look at the, you know, living experiences and all other issues of economic ownership, who has jobs, who is unemployed, you will see that there is no such thing as rainbow nation. And we don't talk talk about these things honestly. Instead, we try to be nice to each other, because I think we need to get to a point whereby we are honest to each other. We say, this is what, those who were advantaged during the apartheid are still advantaged to this day. What do we do to correct these issues? And that's what we are not doing. As long as we are not doing that, these things are just going to escalate to a point that I think one day we will definitely have a physical confrontation, wide scale to that extent, because of being nice and soft on this issue.
Tumosa,
the whole thing about racism, as a black person, I'm exhausted, I'm tired, and I'm not going to explain racism to a white person. It's their duty to understand what makes me feel uncomfortable, or what I consider to be racist, so that they don't do it. So in terms of us sitting together and trying to figure things out, I feel like sometimes Helen, when she speaks, of course she's a white woman, she speaks on a position of privilege when it comes to this, and she's never experienced racism, Helen, so she doesn't even know what it is, nor understands it, hence she speaks like this. But you see, what happens when you allow people like Helen to drive the narrative is that you end up diluting the whole conversation of what exactly racism is, and you end up exhausting yourself by explaining it to them. So as much as we need a kind of a social thing around this whole racism thing, personally, I'm not willing to get into that with white people. Never, ever, ever. They need to figure it out.
Kwanisa, let's go back into the DA's issue here, because if we look at it, the party has come under fire for this before, and it's not the first time that Helen Zille has made tweets of this nature. And she's been warned about this by Musi Maimane once before. But what does this say? I mean, we always criticize the ANC for factions speaking on factions and various people speaking about other people, and now it's happening quite frequently within the DA. And this is based on racial lines. How do we interpret this for the DA?
I think you can't accuse Helen Zille of not being consistent. She's always been consistent. And the reality is that I am sure there were hundreds of people who, and I say white people, but also maybe supporters of the DA, members of the DA, leaders of the DA, that probably invalidated in their minds the experience of Phumzile Van Dam, particularly because, she punched the guy, and people want to know, no, we need to know exactly what happened. You can't, it's a matter of racism, it's a matter of how you feel. You made me feel subhuman. You made me feel like I was just, because I was black. And you cannot go in the matter of trying to break this down scientifically. No, you made me feel as if I was subhuman. And that should be enough to believe Phumzile Van Dam and say that I was so angered about how I was treated that I was led to a violent encounter. Now, Helen Zille has consistently played this card where she's almost it's like this sarcastic undertone to people's lived experiences of racism. The same way she questions reports about the fact that black people are worse off than white people, all of those kind of things. And the reality is, you would think that in 2019 we'd all be on the same on the same page to say there was a huge injustice that happened. We are not equal as a society. We won't be equal for a very long time. Therefore, we need to have these conversations and these actions. But I think Helen Zille is consistently playing into a certain constituency of hers. I don't know if this is basically her paving out her future as a politician, but she is consistently pushing appeasing to almost right-leaning constituency of the DA, liberal constituency of the DA, And the reality of it is that this is what we see that's spilling over in the public. We shouldn't think about it as a trois. Mm. It undermines actually what's happening. That, you know, these are two people that's just fighting it out on social media. This is a person who had experienced, had a lived experience of racism. She spoke out about it. She tried to do something to defend herself about it. And on the other hand, it's you have... you have a former leader of the party, a white leader, former leader of the DA, trying to invalidate her experience.
Let's talk about this very quickly, Zingisa. If we look at this whole scenario, everyone's asking, where is Musi Maimane in all of this? You know, the man's been quiet, and he always seems to be quiet when it comes to these things. Should he be taking more action against Helen Zille, but does he have the power to take this much action? Because we've always seen this sort of power divide between the two of them, and people always question, who's really in charge of the DA here?
Look, I mean, before I answer your question, I just wanted to add on a point that Kwanita was saying. On this whole thing of Helen Zille and a particular constituency that she appeals to, it is exactly what I was saying earlier on, that racism is well and alive in South Africa, and the likes of Helen Zille know about it. They know, she knows when she speaks for lots of people, probably millions, just that others are not brave enough like her to speak out. Same thing goes for Mr. Steve Hofmeyr, who's also embroiled in his own racial shenanigans almost time and again. In fact, between him and Zille, there's no difference. The same person, the other one is male, the other one is female. They know what emboldens them is the fact that they know that they are not speaking, these are not just their personal views, these are the views of many people like them, just that others choose, because we have this whole approach in South Africa that, yeah, you can't say certain things, you can, you know, you must try to nurse each other's feelings, and they speak out because they know that they are supported. I mean, Steve Hofmeyr has been like this all these years, but his music continues to thrive. He lives a nice life, his music gets bought because he's got supporters who believe in the views that he believes in. Anyway, coming back to Musi, Musi Shem-ish.
Wow!
I don't care. No, I feel for him. I mean, because seriously, this guy, Helen Zille, on the political aspect of things, Helen Zille has always spoke against, not only on racial issues, even on policy issues of the DA. Mm. He always speaks the opposite of what the party is about. And the person who's supposed to put him into line, for instance, let's make an example about the ANC, well, fictional as it is.
Yes.
When Esma Khashude spoke, for instance, on the Reserve Bank issue, the president came out and put
it right.
You know, it right, his firm foot on the ground.
I'm not sure.
Well, that's up for debate. But at least he did something to show that he is the man in charge.
Yes.
Which Musi has failed to do time and again. And I believe this is what exactly emboldens Helen Zille, because it paints a picture that she is more powerful than Musi Maimane. I don't know whether Musi Maimane actually is the leader of the DA, or perhaps, as Stemmis Omsomo once wrote a book about him titled Prophet or Puppet. I don't know, because anything points to the fact that, to the latter, that he is actually a puppet. He's a person who's not in charge of the DA.
And you know, when we criticize people like Phumzile Lefandam, for example, I'll use that example, Musi Maimane, to say, watch out, you are being put in these positions by white people because you are tolerable to them. They deny this thing.
Yeah.
They said they believed that they were, that it was their merit and nothing else. And many, many critics said that it was convenient for the DA to put these type, to effectively parachute these type of people into the national political sphere. And now they, in retrospect, they can see what was the consequence of, or what actually was at play when you have people like Helen Zille saying it was a bad decision to put black people there. And that's why you see people like Phumzile Lefandam now deciding to reassert herself against people like Helen Zille, who effectively believe in their minds that I made these people.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know, I always feel sorry for Musi, because one, Helen is no longer a mayor. Two, Helen holds no position, leadership position in the DA. He's some sort of a veteran, nyana nje, somewhere. But it's just that people pay too much attention to what she says. Well, she says a lot of divisive nonsense. Obviously, we will get angry. But I don't like the fact that Helen's racism and disrespect of black people is going to be put on Moses' shoulders all the time. I mean, he's also black like us. He gets tired. He's also tired. So maybe we must all deal with Helen and leave Moses alone.
So is Helen like Jacob's...
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Actually, she is.
Oh, let's take an air break before we get out. We're going to take a quick air break. Join us when we get back. We're going to be talking about the story of the week, and this time it's going to be on State of the Nation address and the current debate that's happening in Parliament as we speak.
Join me, Paul Ash, in a beautiful soundscape as we explore the world in the Sunday Times Travel Podcast. Find it at sundaytimes.co.za.
To advertise on the Sunday Times Politics Weekly Podcast, email us at smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. That's smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. Welcome back, guys. Moving on, we've all read and seen and watched aspects about the President's State of the Nation address last week. We're not going to spend too much time on that because it's sort of all news now. Let's look at some of the big highlights from his State of the Nation address last week. The President proposed a special appropriation bill, which is to be tabled to allocate a significant portion of the $230 billion that Eskom needs to pay its debtors and keep the lights on. The President also reaffirmed the constitutional mandate of the Reserve Bank to protect the value of our currency in the interest of its balanced and sustainable growth. And that's obviously after that whole debacle with these and other members of the ANC around the mandate of the Reserve Bank. There was also a whole bunch of other things that caught some attention. The President dreams of the first new city, smart city, being built in a democratic era with skyscrapers, schools, universities, hospitals, and all the rest. So a lot of people criticize it for being a whole bunch of pipe dreams. Some people saying that it's good that the President has a vision for the future, even though it's somewhat unattainable. Currently, in Parliament, opposition parties are debating the President's State of the Nation address. I haven't seen it because I've been sitting up at the State Capture Inquiry. What did I understand that Musi Maimane has spoken already, Julius Malema has spoken already. Have you guys watched any of it? Anything that caught your attention so far?
Yeah. Well, I have, but first of all, perhaps just my reflection on the President's speech.
Go ahead.
Just brief.
Was it George Cole?
Well, as you say, I mean, in fact, I wish we had a clip from your comments on what you were expecting last week. I thought I was going to ask for it to be played because I think it was quite pointed on what the President ought to have done, which he failed dismally.
Yes.
In terms of, you had said last week that you wanted to hear details, not just, broad plans, when it doesn't say when and how and for
we
how
wanted
much.
A plan.
Yeah. Well, he failed dismally there. For me, the President's speech was just another speech, very weak in content and detail.
But very good in politicking.
Yeah, very good. Well, I don't know, even in politicking, if it's good. Because, I mean, I haven't seen a speech of a sitting president being attacked like this one. Even, the scandal-prone former president, Jacob Zuma, in terms of, not him, the character, but in terms of his speeches, it has never happened that a speech is attacked like this. And I guess the dreaming part was the last straw that just gave everyone that whole thing. For me as well, I'm on that. I mean, the President, as Julius Malema said, doesn't have the luxury to dream. I mean, we've been dreaming for far too long. It's been 5 years now. Even the new city that he's talking about, he's not the first one to talk about this thing.
Why don't we fix our old cities first before we start dreaming
about
new cities?
Before you build bullet trains, why don't you fix the current trains? President was stuck for 4 hours in Soshanguve in a train.
Yeah.
When is he fixing that train? Well, this is what Julius Malema said today. So coming back to your question on today, Julius Malema was quite sharp and pointed in criticizing the President and telling him to actually wake up and smell the coffee and start implementing, because that is his mandate. He has no time. I mean, there's been a lot of visions. The NDP, for instance, has been there. What happened to the NDP now? I mean, as Julius Malema correctly puts it, the NDP envisioned 11 million jobs by 2030.
president comes and visions 2 million jobs in 10 years, yes, which is 2029, exactly, just a year before what the NDP had envisaged. You know, on the other side, there's a bloodbath of jobs. How are you going to cap that? Well, the president didn't say anything about retrenchments, and they are quite massive. They are happening now. As we heard, for instance, multi-choice, 2,000 plus jobs are going to be shed. So, really, I don't know, man, but it was not an inspiring speech. In fact, for me, now, personally, I think that the old people are completely clueless about how to take this country forward. I think their time is over. It's a time for new ideas and fresh ideas from fresh and young people. Old people, it's game over.
But I
agree with Zikisa. I mean, we've been made promises over the past 20 years or 25 years, and I hazard to say that we haven't really seen any progress in a lot of those promises. And what we expected, what I expected in this past owner, was a detailed plan, as we said last week, that says, in the next 5 years, although I might not be able to change the whole country around, I'm looking at this aspect and this aspect and this aspect, and this is how I'm going to change things slowly, but eventually get to where we're going, even if it takes us in the next 30 years, for instance. So give us a plan and let us know how things are going. Kwanisa, what did you were there. What did you make of the president's speech last week?
I think it was incoherent. I think it was a missed opportunity. But there was an interesting bit of the speech that stood out for me, was Ramaphosa's concession, is that we can't announce, we don't have money.
Yeah.
So how do you detail plans? Literally, how do you detail plans when this country has no money? So you literally, you need to sort out the energy sector. We have energy stability, but you have this Eskom drama that's going on. You want to unbundle Eskom, but you're dealing with unions. You need to create jobs, but there's a bloodbath in retrenchments. You understand?
Yeah.
So at some point, it almost felt like it was him kind of accepting defeat of sorts, to say, you know what? All I can continue doing is just dreaming, because really it's too where do I start? Almost, it was like how I don't think there was a plan presented, because there is no plan.
But this is a scary thought. It really is a scary thought. As you're going on, I was just reading a few quotes from him just now, and it almost seemed, as you said, that he's like, I wish this could happen, but this is what's standing in the way, and I don't really know how to deal with this. But if I could have it the way I wanted, this is what I could do for you in the future. But it's a scary thought that we don't almost have a plan going forward.
I think the best that can happen in the next 5 years is just a cleanup of what happened in the last 5 years.
But then we don't get anywhere.
So you don't move forward, but you kind of just get back to where you initially were as a country in restoring institutions. I think that's the best case scenario. The best case scenario.
And then you ask for second term. That's good grounds for second term. That's how people ask for second terms.
No, but seriously, if you just think about. Let's take the issue of corruption in public works. Corruption in public works probably is what led to Nkandla, right? And it's something that has persisted and persisted and persisted, right? So you put Patricia de Lille there. So she's going to cost save for you. She's not going to allow some corruption. Patricia de Lille is probably the right person. But you're not going to have any serious change or reform in any way. What you're going to do is just have someone who's going to keep it afloat a little bit. If you look the same, for example, the story in the Sunday Times this week about Ramaphosa's intention to appoint Jeff Khadebe and Derek Hanekom as advisors, as special envoys. And the reality is, all of that drama about how you're going to reduce cabinet and do away with old people and fresh young blood, and you're doing what Zuma did. Zuma did the same thing. He made all former ministers advisors and he sent them as ambassadors. That's what Zuma did. So the reality of it is, this speech for me was important because it gave us a real indication of how much trouble Ramaphosa is as a president, and how much he's in the stalemate of not being able to move on what he really wants to do because of the pre-existing conditions.
So I'm guessing what you're saying is that the country was brought to its knees over the past 10 years, and we've sort of got to stand up before we can start to jump
again.
No,
I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying that's my assessment. I'm not saying that you should first clean up before you move forward. If you had, like you said, Zingisa, if you have innovative ideas, you can come up with plans to say, this is what we're going to do here, this is what we're going to do here, this is, even with the restrictions that are in place.
Well, talking about innovative ideas, I'm going to get to you now, but let's talk about this. Musi Maimane spoke in Parliament and I thought he had some good points to make. Let's look at some of the things he said. He said, today we have floods in KZN and droughts in the Western Cape. This is the future that we must plan for. And before we build smart cities, we should be building sustainable cities. Elsewhere in the world, countries are using smart technology to keep their people healthy and safe. Solutions like smartphone screening to detect cervical cancer and so on. This should be part of our plan too. This is what Musi Maimane is saying. He says, I hear everyone speaking about the fourth industrial revolution these days, but I'm not sure they know what it is. Giving our children tablets at schools is not the fourth industrial revolution, but preparing them for jobs that don't exist yet is. And that's a good point, Smasa.
While we are on our knees and the administration is trying to figure out how to get out of the mess, we need to urgently address the issue of unemployment.
Of course.
You know, for an example is multi-choice. Well, multi-choice, there's a lot of greed there that led to a lot of people unsubscribing and whatever. But you also have to look at streaming services that we have opted for.
Mm.
Is our government taxing them? You know, is our government taxing Uber? Uber is not from here. Is our government getting money from Taxify and taxing them?
Netflix. What?
I don't want to mention them because they are my face. but I mean, while we are losing money in industries that are dying because of the fourth industrial revolution,
we aren't making money.
Are we making money in the industries that are popping up? You know, so
we. That's a good point.
But the reality of the situation is that if you seriously ask cabinet ministers what is their thoughts and ideas of the fourth industrial revolution, they really can't give you a concrete answer. And the reality of it is, it's not that insane of robots running in our streets. It's just that when you go to a public hospital, you're not carrying a thick paper file that's being lost tomorrow.
Yeah.
Or when you file an affidavit with the police, you don't have to now, you know, someone can't just steal it from the records. It's
But what's preventing our country from doing the most basic things as putting
digitization?
Hey,
why?
This thing starts with the ANC. Do you know, like, to be an ANC member today,
you have to fill a form,
go to a bank, attach a slip.
I know.
The governing party that is in charge, they still don't have a digitalized membership system.
They don't have a website after a couple of months.
Well,
So, what do you expect? No, but it's serious. I mean, you can sound like a joke, but what do you expect from that kind of people?
You're saving paper and you're saving a whole lot of nonsense of things getting lost and missing and you know,
also,
being stolen.
But also, you appoint Ibrahim Patel as now this minister that's going to take this country forward in economic development and trade and industry. The man have been there. And the reality of it is, you have, you know, when I observe a particular minister, Bladen Zimande, and his apparent distaste and for any fresh ideas that's not his own.
Why? But because he's a dictator within the
country.
And he's been there, that guy, for 20 years.
So if you're going to have someone who has this grand idea to say, okay, let's streamline something in NASFAS to ensure A, B, and C, you're going to have a minister immediately rejected. You're going to have lawmakers thinking about the future long after something has come. For example, we've never envisioned e-hailing legislation in South Africa. Uber had to come, Taxify had to come, whatever, for lawmakers to realize, oh, we need to make a law. And then when they do make laws, it's laws that are prohibitive instead of laws that are complementary and collaborative, in the sense that you help this industry while you, instead of banning it, it's a whole argument that's also made with, you know, with like the taxi industry and whatever. It's because our lawmakers don't know this future. They don't know these things. Therefore, you just have, no, we must run away from it. You understand? That is the nature of the politics, and I hope that we can start having this discussions that are more, that are not like, oh, fourth industrial revolution. No. Let's talk about why are courts not digitalized. Let's start there.
Okay, we're going to take another quick ad break, and when we get back, we're going to talk, we're going to get into our last section, what to expect when you're unsuspecting. Join us when we get back. We're going to be talking about what we're sort of expecting from Ramaphosa's Sonar response on Thursday. It's Thursday.
Yeah.
And we're also going to be talking about another news development. Jacob Zuma, it appears, is coming to the state capture inquiry. Catch us when we're back.
Young people are making their mark. Get up!
Tune into the Sebenza Live Behind the Hustle podcast every Tuesday to find out more about what fascinating careers are out there. You can find us on the Sowetan Live website,
or you can follow us on Twitter on Sebenza Live.
Sebenza boy.
Sebenza girl.
Sebenza.
Yabamdana.
To advertise on the Sunday Times Politics Weekly podcast, email us at smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. That's smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. Hey, welcome back. So, let's get back into it. The former president will attend the state capture inquiry on the 15th to the 19th of July. When he gets there, though, we hope that he actually says something that's of substance. Because on Tuesday, his lawyers told us that they've accepted the letters from the commission, constantly calling them to make provision for Zuma to come and attend. And after a whole bunch of criticism of the commission, the president's lawyers has eventually given a sort of inclination that he will come to attend at the inquiry between the 15th and the 19th of July. It's going to be massive, guys, because from attending the commission, Zuma's name has popped up almost everywhere. In Agrizi's testimony, Angelo Agrizi from Bososa, the president was apparently paid thousands, hundreds of thousands of rands per month through his foundation from Bososa. There was allegations from ANN7 that Zuma had sort of run ANN7 on the sideline from creative director of ANN7, and a whole bunch of other things when it came down to appointments, influence over SOE. So the former president has a lot to answer for. But we all know how the former president is. He's been asking for his day in court for the past, 20 years almost. And he's never got it because he never wanted to have it, really. Now that he's been sort of forced, the commission really did push him into a corner. Because his argument was that he wanted the questions beforehand, and that's never been done in the commission before. He wanted the special treatment where he says, well, give me the questions, and I'll come and give you the answers. But actually, he's got so much to answer for, and how it works is that the commission will give you a 3.3 notice, and it tells you, you have been implicated in this person's testimony. This is what they said about you. What would you like to say in response? That's basically like asking a question. It's, what is your response to this allegation? That is your question. So they've been telling you this from the inception, from the first testimony when you were implicated. Now all of a sudden you say, oh, I want a list of 10 questions that I can respond to, for example. It's rubbish. But anyway, We're expecting to see him at the state capture inquiry. What do you guys think? Do you think we'll actually get some substance or some response to those allegations that are set against him?
You won't.
I don't think so.
No, we won't. We won't. I mean, even if you read his letter now, succumbing to this,
it was scathing of the commission. He basically said I don't believe in your process.
He does. He actually rubbishes the credibility of the commission. I mean, there's a line here where he says, or the lawyers, of course, on his lawyers writing to, we hereby advise that our client has decided to grant the commission its wishes, but listen to this, all wishes of those who advise
that's
or
exact,
instructed.
Yes, so that's exactly what I was like.
He's already painting a picture to say that this is not genuine. I'm not being called here genuine. I'm called here because somewhere my enemies have instructed the commission to call me. He goes on to say, yeah, you guys don't want to email, send me questions because you want to ambush me and humiliate me. So he's playing the typical victim card of Jacob Zuma as we know
him. But this is a strategy of his, isn't it? Because we've seen this even emerge within the EFF, where if they're expecting something, some negative reporting about them, then they'll preempt it. And they'll say, no, this white monopoly capital media institution here is being paid to
if
do this.
It's the
judiciary. Now it's the same with Zuma. It's an old tactic to say that, well, actually this thing is captured, but I'm going to go
you
here
know,
and
yeah,
fight
against
this
victim. You know, initially when we started to get to know this Jacob Zuma who plays the victim card, I thought that maybe it's because the man wanted to be president. So the man was president and everything happened, but now he's no longer president. He has nothing to lose. What else is he going to get by hiding and playing victim and just playing games with us? We're tired, man.
But you see, the thing is, right, it's extremely consistent with his approach to whether it's responding to civil cases against him, criminal cases against him, public protectors finding against him. It's what you do is you're this big victim that is now, you know, fighting for your survival, and the whole world is unfair to you. And the reality of it is, if you know, I think we should find that clip where Zuma outside of court said, was it outside of court or said in an interview, that not one person at the state capture inquiry implicated him. And I was
what have you been
shouting off the rooftops of what did Zuma do wrong, you know, the famous line. But like now they want to tell you when that is now we tell you Zondo is ready to tell you.
And I mean, besides, I don't understand why former President Zuma is behaving in this manner, because first of all, the commission is not a court of law. It's not like he's going to be arrested by coming here. And as he has consistently claimed that he hasn't done anything wrong, and as he claimed that he was not being implicated, so if you are not implicated, why don't you come here and say, well, this thing that was said by this person is just hearsay, these are the facts. This thing that is said by this is lies and rubbish, these are the facts. Simple. You get out of it and then you get to the end. If really people were making up lies about you as he would like us to believe, at the end of the commission when it makes its recommendations, you're not going to be implicated, and then you can shout on top of roofs.
The thing is, it's under oath. You can say everything in the media, you can say all of these things outside of your court appearance, but now this is under oath.
Yeah. No, but that's what I'm saying. If he really believes that he is being
I'm sure you surely cannot. But answering Zamasa's question, she asked, what does the president have to lose? And we've all sort of interacted with the president at least once or twice in our careers. And for me, I think he has to lose is his legacy. He's a very proud man, and he wanted to leave something behind that showed that I took control of this country and I saved it.
No. Here's the thing with the former president. It's either you know his shenanigans or you are a fan of him. You'll never be in the middle with him. So you have the RET forces that believe that Zuma is innocent, Zuma has done no wrong ever, and he's this savior of black people. And you have everyone else who says, okay, this is what he's done, these are the facts. So his legacy, it's already divided. There is no more dividing it. He's not going to get anyone in the middle who's going to say, oh, maybe he's a good man, oh, maybe he's not a good man. So he might as well just, the people who've stuck with him will continue to stick with him, whether or not
if he admits
this
it.
This is about jail. This is about jail. Literally, this is about jail.
But he's old now. He's not going to go to jail.
But it's not about going to jail. It's about fighting to stay out of jail until you die.
And selling books and heads.
I'm waiting to see.
Let's move on very quickly to another aspect. So President Cyril Ramaphosa is going to be back in Parliament on Thursday, and he's going to be giving his responses to the SONA debate, which is currently happening now. Very quickly, just across the table, how do you guys think that the president's going to deal with the criticism from his address? Are we going to see more of the Ramaphosa sort of showboating, or are we going to see a bit more of a humbled approach from the president, maybe? Quickly, on the table, what do you guys think?
I'm expecting to see a Ramaphosa who looks like he just wants to go and chill with his uncle, drink his wine, and, you know, count his money. And because, honestly, I think he's just really confused. He doesn't know what to do, and it's very difficult for him. So, and South Africa, it's a country, it's not a business. So we all expect, you know, there's miracles from him, because, you know, this is how well he did in business. And a shame, the poor guy. Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Shame.
Hey, Chief, I don't know what to expect from this fellow anymore. Well, probably I agree with Zuma. I think he's just clueless in the bigger scheme of things about how to take the country forward. He wanted this thing. He got it. He realized when he's already in. Actually, I believe he probably at some times when he's sitting alone and asking himself questions, what did I get myself into this mess? It's not as easy as it looks from the outside. I mean, he's wanted this position since the early years of our democracy. Now he's got it. He's stuck with ANC factions that are pushing him all over the show, and literally poor soul can't do anything about it. I think, well, he's got an opportunity to salvage himself and perhaps explain his dreams, but I just hope it doesn't win any favor.
I mean, a quote of Julius Malema in his contribution to the debate really stood out for me, where he said the country doesn't see what Nelson Mandela saw in Cyril Ramaphosa. And I think that this debate is not really a debate, because it's the SONA was not substantial enough to warrant the opposition making serious responses. Perhaps it was part of an effort to muddy the waters or just keep things calm. But I do think that Ramaphosa will try to save his face and be a lot more specific and more assertive in his response to the debate. You remember earlier this year, the debate was characterized by what was his Terry Rekota saying he was a spy, and that was all of those kind of shenanigans that was happening. Obviously, that's the nature of political debate. But I do think that Ramaphosa will have to look beyond all of the sloganeering and all of this sort of politicking. Elections are over. Really, elections are over. In fact, when I looked at his speech, Zingiza, I thought, this is a really good speech before elections. You know what I mean? Like, this is a good pre-election speech. Like, you know, like, elect me and therefore I'll do this. But the thing is, you have electoral power. And then the other thing is, what you also have to not forget is that this debate also comes with the shadow of Busisiwe Mkabane, and the president has to respond to her by Friday.
Of course.
And Julius Malema also said something interesting, where he said that we don't want to remove you, but don't be a constitutional delinquent. He says the ANC is in a mess. We can't remove you. You were democratically elected. It kind of says what the opposition is thinking when it comes to this matter. But really, I think that Ramaphosa is facing his first real test as a president, or first serious issue as a president, and it's basically how he responds to it is going to show his character.
Alright, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you all so much for joining us. Remember, if you like the podcast, please interact with us on Twitter at #STPoliticsWeekly, and please share the podcast far and wide. If you've enjoyed it, tell your friends about it. We appreciate all the support we can get. And remember, if you want to advertise on the podcast, you can contact Scott Smith on smiths@tisoblackstar.co.za. If you want to find our podcast as well, you can go onto our Times Live website under the Opinions and Analysis page, or on Iono FM. We'll share all those links on Twitter with you guys. To my comrades, thanks you guys so much for joining us this week, and we'll catch you all again next week, same time, same place.
Bye.